Welcome to Petrolicious Talks, conversations, stories, and deep dives celebrating all the automotive world has to offer. Join me, Afshin Benia, founder of Petrolicious, as we chat with designers and drivers, enthusiasts and entrepreneurs, collectors and craftsmen, examining what they drive and what drives them. My guest today is Mazen Fawaz, CEO of Singer Vehicle Design. Thanks so much for joining me, Maz.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
So you're relatively recently been appointed to CEO at Singer Vehicle Design, but you have a long history with the company, right? You were involved from the very beginning as a consultant, if I'm not mistaken.
I met Rob actually when he was doing car number one.
Wow. That's about 10 years ago or so?
It's about 10 years ago. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, we met in the parking lot of Singer, sort of. Singer was in a little space in a building with a lot of other things going on. And we just made almost immediate friends. And from there, I was just a friend and a fan, and then ultimately helped move the car from sort of an earlier 911 chassis to the 964. And that's kind of how I was involved. And that was kind of as a consultant. I wouldn't say the business was that formal at the time. They had done two cars.
Did your friendship start around cars to begin with, or how did you guys meet?
Yeah, of course. You know, like car lunatics are, you know, right. It's what we talk about 98% of the time. But it was, you know, I had just moved to California to start my business, which is in technology. And what Rob was doing and Singer was doing was entertaining for me. I don't know that I really took it particularly serious as a business. It really wasn't at the time. I would say it was more of an artistic endeavor. And I think Rob aimed to be a designer, right? To be in the design business, rather. He was already a designer, but to be in the design business, not necessarily the car business or the manufacturing business.
So a lot of us Singer fans and people in the automotive have heard Rob's story, but few of us know your background. What were you, I know, so you said you were in the technology field, but what were you doing prior to Singer?
Prior to Singer, I had starting businesses here and there. I had one sort of primary business. It was in buying and selling electricity in Michigan. But I was always staring at cars and playing with motorcycles and all that since, you know, birth.
Yeah.
Sort of had that disorder a lot of people have. Quite focused, I would say. And everything I did was, you know, probably configured to figure out how to spend more time messing with cars and so on. And, you know, prior to Singer, I had bought several things, taken them apart, rebuilt them, anything from, you know, sort of old 911s to a Land Rover. I had a Defender 90 that I took down to nothing and rebuilt it using, you know, but covered it in sound deadening and had electric door locks and to this sort of resto modding thing, but back, I would say that was the late 90s, early 2000s. Right. Not as a business now, just for myself.
Just for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. It was what Rob was doing was sort of second nature to me in a sense.
So you took on the CEO role at Singer, what, about a couple of years ago?
No. Last November.
Last November. Wow. Okay.
End of November. Yeah.
But throughout these 10 years, you've been involved in some capacity with Singer, right?
Yeah. You know, so when I met him, they were doing car number one. And then there was, you know, he said a few people have asked me, you know, if I could build them one of these, right?
Yeah.
He'd been asked, he'd been approached by several customers, several meaning like two or three.
Right.
And I said, that's super cool. And the cars are beautiful. And, you know, we sort of remained friends. And then there was some interest from a client and potentially, you know, being involved or investing or something. And I sort of helped Rob with that conversation and spreadsheets and some other stuff. This was this sort of, you know, a little bit of sort of business discussion. But then when there was three or four customers, you know, I started looking at how repeatable the product was. It was very difficult to make. It was effectively a one-off. And that's how sort of moving to the 964 came about. Right. And that was that was an idea we had. And then I helped sort of transition the car to the 964 to the specification, really where it is today, the motor, and so on. So I worked as a, you know, kind of a, I would say in quotes, a consultant. It was really like a friend doing something that was cool. It was still such a low volume of cars that it just didn't occur to me as a business. Occurred to me as, you know, having fun with a friend of mine doing something cool while I'm building, you know, while I'm building a quote real business, which was, you know, in data and technology and all of that. And so that's what, you know, so I helped put, you know, called up some folks and got in touch with Cosworth, and we, you know, developed a motor and specified the car in a lot of ways. It's still the same car today, the dampers and brakes and all of that. And I was really focused on how the car would go down the road and how it would sound and all of that.
What were some of the reasons that you were pushing to go to the 964 platform?
Well, the primary reason was my first, so a little bit of a story. I was a teenager. I was at University of Michigan, and I would, there was a small Ferrari dealer in Dearborn, Michigan. And I used to go there all the time and stare at things. And they always had these fantastic used cars. They had this, the owner of the place had this terrific taste. They had things like Jaguar XJR15s and Cosworth Escorts. And I was just fantastic F40s and all this great stuff.
Yeah.
And the owner of the place is a fabulous guy named Bob Schneider. And he saw me there every day.
You know, so what's wrong with this guy?
Right. Staring at everything. And he said something along the lines like, well, you're here every day doing nothing. I assume you're a student. I said, yeah. He said, well, why don't you help around here if you're going to come every day? Something along those lines. And he had to go drop a car off, or they had to drop a car off somewhere else in Michigan. He said, why don't you follow me there and drive me back, and you can start working here as like a porter or whatever. So he hands me the keys to a 600-mile mint green 1992 911. Ooh. And until then, the coolest thing I'd ever driven was like, you know, my mom's Honda Accord or something. Not that that's cool, but, and it was just, that was sort of game changing. It changed my life that day, right? I drove this fantastic thing. Mint green at the time wasn't as cool as it is now. Now it's very cool. Back then, it was just sort of shocking. And then I started working there.
Were you nervous as hell with that first drive?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was crazy. I was 17. It was a big, very big moment for me. I'll never forget it. I can even picture the road we drove. We drove very slowly and was very cautious and all that. But for the subsequent couple of years while I was studying and either working there, I eventually was too busy and I was just studying, but I'd go there all the time as friends with everybody. But I drove everything. I drove 308s at the, at the time, 308s and 328s and 348s and eventually the 355. And I drove F40s and Testarossas.
What a dream.
F5 Toll 3. Yeah, everything Ferrari made until that time. But also previously the dealer had a lot of, they were an Aston Lamborghini Lotus dealer prior to sort of my time there. But they had clients' cars in for repair. I mean, I drove all this stuff at the time, LM002s and whatever. And then all these cool used cars. So I had this fantastic bunch of experiences. We spent a lot of time at racetracks, and somehow my head always went back to this 964 and kind of how they did it right compared to all of this stuff. I still preferred this car, not just because it was the first one and was sort of romantic or whatever, but because it just made a lot of sense. The car just worked well. Let's just start with that, right?
Yeah.
Compared to the Italian things, which were sort of like paper mache compared to this 911, which felt like it was made of, you know, granite. And then just the way it was balanced and all of this sort of connection to the rear of the car, I thought was very special. The connection to the contact patch, the tires in the rear, was very interesting. Was unlike all these other things. The other things thrilled me in a different way, right? They were gorgeous and they made amazing noises, and, you know, things like F40s and all that were, you know, scary and so on. But it just always stuck in my head. And then the 993 came out and I thought that was fantastic, but it was it was a little bit disassociated with the chassis.
Too much of a departure.
Well, in the rear, it's a lot more comfortable to drive, a lot more comfortable as a daily driver. But, you sort of lost the sort of raw connection. So when I met Rob and he was rebodying an eight, I think there were 89 911s. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, the body is the same on a 964, but Porsche did this very weird thing, which they made a car that was under nearly an identical skin, same door, same window, same, you know, very, very, very similar. But underneath right. all of that, completely changed. Like yeah. every surface, if you open up the boot lid to a 89 SC, or not an SC, rather an 89 911 or 964, even all the surfaces, the metalwork is unrelated. Forget the components. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everything is different, and it was quite a thing. So the transition, we sort of shrugged our shoulders and said, well, probably it's not that hard, right? It was yeah. complete rewrite, by the way, total rewrite of every right. single thing, even the exterior bodywork, it all had to be sort of retooled. But then you had this car that was relatively repeatable because at the same time, and this was over the course of only like a year that I kind mm-hmm. of, you know, quote, worked there. It was really as my tech business was, we were writing software and doing things that I'm not even qualified to participate in.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of kind of downtime. But then the car was tooled, meaning it mm-hmm. became, you know, you started to, you know, create molds and patterns for things so that it could be right. repeatable, but still.
What made the 964 platform more repeatable for you guys versus the previous, the G-body?
Well, the process of the transition meant that the business invested in some tools and some repeatability that could have been done on the earlier cars, but it wasn't. The earlier cars uh-huh. were really very, very much by hand.
One-offs.
But the 964 has a more torsionally rigid chassis. The suspension is, you know, mm-hmm. cast aluminum, very high tech compared to the previous year, you know, composite fuel tanks and, you know, power windows and ABS brakes and air conditioning and all this other stuff, power steering, all the stuff that made the car a lot more usable, a lot more friendly, still very raw, right?
Yeah.
But under the same skin. So a car could look like what Rob designed, but drive in an easier way and more comfortable way and a safer way. And
so there's a lot more latitude to what you could do with a chassis with a 964 in a sense.
Kind of. You use more modern damping.
Yeah.
Sway bars and everything else. Everything was a giant step forward. Braking. It has ABS brakes for what it's worth.
Yeah.
The way the shifter mechanism works, everything sort of was a huge upgrade, and just generally made a lot more sense. And the car, as a result, doesn't drive so much like a hot rod. Uh-huh. You know, when I say a hot rod, I mean, think of like a 60s Mustang or something that's
yeah.
you know, cool, but difficult, right?
You right.
gotta, much the earlier
more composed.
Cars. Uh-huh. Yeah. So this car felt a lot more natural. Like it was meant to be configured like this rather than you've put, you know, a huge motor in an old car or something, yeah. which maybe isn't quite balanced. Right. So
sure.
what we got was a very balanced car, and it was, nice. it was something that where you can go out and kind of wring its neck, and no one thing was a drag, right? Nothing mm-hmm. stood out as a problem, the braking system or the sway bars or it was very fluid.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, I mean, that took countless hours of, you know, driving and calibration and testing and tuning.
I
mean, it's not
I
like
imagine.
You just bolt a bunch of stuff together and you think it's going to work well. That's not how it goes, right?
And so today, the ultimate expression of what you guys have done is the DLS, right? The dynamics and lightness study.
Yeah. Dynamic and lightweighting study. Yep. We did. In England.
So this huge win for you guys, the whole collaboration with Williams. How, you know, I imagine it wasn't easy to get such a team to work with you guys, or was it? Like, how did you guys sell them on the idea of a business partnership like that?
So that's where I became more formally involved with the business, uh-huh. which was, you know, this idea for basically for a new product or a different product. Singer at the time was growing. It had a lot of, you know, sort of a lot more people, a lot more going on. I was very busy with my business, the one that had gone there to start had grown and was 50, 60 people at the time. But the concept of, you know, lightweighting further what Singer was doing was something, obviously not something that Singer invented, lightweight 911s, yeah. But something that, you know, we talk about over a beer or whatever and think, you know, wouldn't that be cool, right? Wouldn't it be cool if we could, what if you could just kind of go crazy? Where, how could you take weight out of a car without making it compromised, right? Where you have this, you know, these very lightweight, you know, hot rod, R group type things, but, you know, they feel lightweight and they feel thin. And how would you go about it? Well, you might take some of the hard components out and redesign them and make them out of lighter weight materials, whether, you know, using aluminum, magnesium, titanium, steel, carbon, obviously. Can you find more areas to take weight out of the car? And that was really the sort of heart of the idea, right? Because at the end of the day, you're sort of limited by, you know, you have a chassis and you have suspension, you have brakes, and you, they can only get so light, right? And then, and of course, then there was this idea around the motor that we had learned over time once we started to do work with, even Cosworth was sophisticated. And the sort of obvious lesson for a lot of 911 engine builders is it's limited by how much air can get into the motor. And that's why they turbocharge them and all of that, but quite a limitation on that car. So it was just a, it was just talk for us. And we talked to a bunch of people about how we, one might go about this, but you know, I was busy and Rob was busy, and it wasn't, I would say, the most serious endeavor, but it was something we couldn't get out of our heads. We kept talking about, and Rob sort of drew up what it might look like, which was just a Singer classic product with some fender arches or whatever, and it was just super cool. That ended up getting shown, or the concept, the conversation ended up getting sort of discussed ultimately with some Singer clients, people I didn't know at this point. They're sort of most distant from Singer because I was very busy, and I would just, you know, show up at parties and stuff. And go to Monterey every year, just fun break. But a couple of customers said they would buy this car. They would, and we knew it would be expensive, right? It was sort of, it'd be $1 million car or something crazy, right? $1.1 million, like really ballsy, right? And then a few folks, the guys at Singer said, hey, you know, we pitched this idea to a few folks and they said they'd buy it. And I was like, really? And Rob was we're both a little bit surprised. And so we took it a little more seriously. And then one day, you know, and we did calculate kind of how much money it would take approximately by just doing some math and asking around. And one day a buddy of mine, Marino Franchitti, who's a racing driver, said, you know, I know an outfit that might be able to quote this work. Cause I said, I want to figure out what it would take to get this done. And he says, Williams. Right. He said he's good friends with Jonathan Williams,
right?
Who's a big 911 fan, big Porsche fan. He said, why don't I put you guys in touch? And, you know, you can see what that's all about. I was like, well, why would they even pay attention to us?
Yeah.
To this goofy idea, right? And that was it. Sort of one thing led to another. And Williams were happy to raise their hand and say, you know, we could do this.
That's pretty amazing. Congrats on that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was relatively... Well, I mean, there's one thing to say you can do it. It's another thing to be able to pay them.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's good to have such a passionate client base that are volunteering to be essentially not beta necessarily, but such early adopters of new products like that and saying, shut up and take my money. So the with the Williams, you guys are like past 500 horsepower, right? Right about there?
Yeah, at speed, it's making more. Oh, yeah. With air being forced into the motor, it is. But not in an engine room.
Right. So that brings up the question, like how much more room do you think this 964 platform has for you guys to keep, you know, increasing power, increasing capabilities, et cetera? Or at what point are you going to hit the wall with that platform?
Well, I tell you what, if we were making racing cars, it would be a walk in the park. I mean, it really would be.
Really?
It's just, well, because there's so much compromise and you don't have to pay attention to it. It doesn't have to be quiet and doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to go down the road, you know.
Of course, yeah. It only has to last for, you know, the duration of a race, et cetera.
Well, sure. It doesn't, you're going over cambers in the road and just all kinds of things, right?
Right.
it would be a breeze, and we could get more power out of the car, and we could make it lighter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that could be done. If you really wanted to make an actual track version of DLS,
yeah,
it would be materially lighter. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of pounds lighter.
Are you hinting at something that we might see in the future from you guys?
potentially. We wouldn't do more of that car. It's a limited, it's a limited thing. It'll stay limited. Yeah. We always obviously are thinking about new things, right? Sure. New products. How can we go forward? I mean, that car is I would say, one would be very challenged to figure out how you would get more, squeeze anything more out of that car as a road car.
Right.
Right. As a road car, I would say that would be very, very hard. And when you invite those folks, the engineering at that level, who are, Formula One engineering and material science is obviously extremely, extremely advanced. Having them work on an analog tractor basically is what we did, right? So
right.
when they attacked a, you know, whatever it was, a bracket or a throttle pedal or a hose or a something, like, I would challenge anyone to take it much further than that.
Yeah.
In terms of an actual road car that actually gets driven, if you wanted to make a one-off that was just super, super, super light, right. Yeah, you could.
Right.
But go down the road in it and have it be balanced and feel right and sound right and work right, and all of that, you know, for the long term. The DLS cars that I've seen tens of thousands of miles and driven extremely hard. Right?
Wow.
We try to break them. The drivers, myself, Marino, Chris Harris, and a guy named Richard Tuthill, and then the test drivers from Williams. So, I mean, you're talking about the sort of lunacy you would find in F1 and chasing the design of a Bolt. There are areas in that car that are incredible that you'll never see ever.
Yeah,
they're just so deep inside things, right? And it's like a mechanical watch in a sense. A lot of people don't know what's going on underneath, and it's pretty incredible. We'll show people eventually what happens when you look underneath DLS, when you kind of see how things work and what we've done there. We haven't done that yet, and that's not exactly deliberate. It's just because we've been very busy. But
yeah. No, I remember like about 5 years ago when I first got a tour of your facilities, I was, and this is obviously well before DLS, I was blown away by what goes under the skin of just a regular Singer, just all the attention to detail, the design, manufacturing, all that stuff. I had no idea. So I can only imagine what the DLS, how much more that takes it forward.
With the classic car, the one we do here in the States, everything is touched. Everything.
Yeah.
There's not a single thing that isn't considered, whether that's a new Porsche part that we buy from Porsche. We spend a lot of money with Porsche. And we take that part in and we might, you know, alter it a little bit or dress it a little bit, or a part we've had commissioned. But everything is considered, and the way it's constructed is considered, the manner in which the car goes together and the sort of care with which things are screwed together and aligned and all of that. It's very, very difficult, very slow, and you have to get everything right.
Yeah.
With DLS, the same thing, except you have a level of engineering and material science to apply to this stuff to get to the same function, right? It's like I said, like a mechanical watch. It's just going to tell time, right?
Sure.
At the end of the day, it probably doesn't even do as good a job as your, phone.
Exactly. Yeah.
But we go about this rather analog function in sort of the most considered way possible, not the most elaborate way possible. That's a big difference. There's folks out there who, you know, sort of over design for design's sake. Right?
Yeah.
But in our case, it really is just pure function. So if you go, what inspired me on a lot of this were like the, I'd say early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s Formula One cars, which we had a lot of access to, where they really, really, really endeavored to take these very mechanical things and make them function in an extreme way. Very simple mechanical thing like a shifter or a brake pedal, right?
Sure.
So it's a thing that has a very basic function. It's not by wire at the time, right? So it wasn't it being improved through software necessarily. It was just, let's try to make this mechanical thing as optimized as possible. So we did that through the whole car.
Yeah.
And but the car's it has ABS, traction control, and ESP, mm-hmm. which we developed with Bosch. So there are some non-analog things in there that a lot of people don't know about.
And how many DLSs are out there now?
We're going to do it 75 times, these commissions.
Right.
And we haven't finished any.
The first one hasn't been delivered yet. It's currently.
Hasn't been delivered. Okay. That's a COVID-19 issue.
Right. Yep.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it's sitting there, you know, waiting to get bolted back together and given back to the customer.
And so since you're kind of pushed this platform to, you know, almost its maximum, it kind of begs the question, when you guys have a couple of years, does the subject of manufacturing your own car ever come up?
It's something we talked about a million times. You know, it's like, wouldn't it be cool to do our own, you know, do a thing? Like, one of the things I feel a lot of people agree with that are probably like yourself, which is, wouldn't it be cool if there was, you know, a modern, lightweight, fun sports car? Everything has gotten so big and everything's gotten so digital.
Sure.
That it's just sort of, you know, it kind of ruined, not ruined, but distanced yourself from the driving experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I think maybe made what we do more and more relevant as these cars, as the capabilities of modern cars have just gone sort of mental, right? I mean, a modern Ferrari or a modern...
Or even a modern Camry. The modern Camry is like a supercar.
Sure. I mean, but there were days when, you know, the 300 ZX twin turbo was like a rocket ship or whatever.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
300 horsepower or something. But now it's really like they've really gone beyond what one can do on a public road by so far. They're so capable. And as engineering exercises, they're mind-blowing. And they really, really are what these companies can do. But as a driving experience... On a public road, they are boring.
Yeah.
They just are for me anyway.
They're isolated.
They're just so capable. They have so much grip and they have so much power that you're never going to get the car out of shape. You're not really controlling it in a sense because you're never pushing it toward.
And it makes you a bad driver. There's nothing you can really do to. I mean, you really have to screw up to get into an accident with a modern car, but. Yeah.
And it's just not that fun. You know, it's just not that fun in a weird way. So we've always had this, like, wouldn't it be cool to, you know, do something like that? But it's such a tiny market, right? Of those folks. And I would argue that they're also aging and so on. So it's something that we've discussed. We have some more Porsche stuff up our sleeve, which is years ahead for us. I mean, we have a lot of people don't. It's interesting. They'll see us and, you know, Instagram and all that, and some, but they don't really understand now the scale of the business. Like I said, way back then, I didn't really take it seriously as a business because, to be honest, it didn't make a lot of sense, right?
Yeah.
It was something that would sort of scale up or whatever. But once I started to become formally involved in the business a couple of years ago for DLS, I did start to pay attention to what was going on. And during that period, after that time, and we started to endeavor with the Formula One team and a partnership with Michelin and really started to kind of step up. We started to become, we've been approached by OEMs to do things together and all kinds of folks to, you know, partnerships or potential products we could do together or something, which none of which we've done quite deliberately. We're keeping our powder dry for some other things, cooking, down the road. But we have had over 300 classic sales. That's the car that we do in California, and then we'll do 75 of the DLSs. So it's now, you know, it's a real business. And you know, when you're in these positions, you have to start looking forward, right?
Right.
I don't mean forward like. next summer.
Sure, sure.
You start looking 5 years out.
5 years down, yeah. And so the DLS is roughly, if I remember correctly, it's like close to $2 million, right, before you start to...
Generally over.
Generally over, okay.
Once they're specified,
To go a little... So I'm curious, and then the classic one is starts around $750K or so. Is that correct?
No, the average price, average transaction there is I think nearing 700, under like six, okay. between 650 and 700, give or take.
Yeah. So what do you think? You know, the market size for this type of supercar is. Like how much? I know you guys have a big backlog of orders, but you know, talking about making it a real business, how big of a market do you foresee in the future?
It's a I tell you, when I was working on the 964 stuff years ago, I think it was like 2013 or something. You know, Rob and I were excited that Singer might do five of them or eight, ever, and then when it got to 10. You just never think it would go to 20. I mean, it didn't make any sense. Right.
Yeah.
And then, remember over this time, I became sort of more and more distant from the business in a sense, just friends. But then it was like 50 and then, and then 75. And it just, you could never, and not that I spent any time on it, but I thought about it a lot, but you would never look at it and say, yeah, I kind of think this could go to, 300. You just don't, there's not a lot of kind of natural analogs for this. There's no, what's a comparative business?
Yeah.
Like another brand that's, you couldn't really look at it and say, well, these guys sold this many cars and, so on. So maybe we can do this many restorations because it's in the same space. And I wasn't really giving it much thought anyway. And DLS started when Singer was at, oh goodness, I want to say like, I can barely remember here, but 150 classic orders.
Wow.
And they've doubled since. And you have things like, we've sold, I think, two cars into Japan.
Right.
Maybe two cars into Germany, right?
Mm-hmm.
These commissions, right? So you have two guys that have 964s in Germany and they want to do these service, have a service performed in their car. Out of all of Germany, you'd think there's probably more, right? There's probably more guys who want this modification and restoration thing on their cars. But how do you calculate the size of that, right?
Sure.
So that's not really how we're going about it, to say like how far can we go, how much can we offer this service out to people. And you have to remember, it's a service, it's not a, we don't sell cars,
of course.
We've never sold a car, actually. And so it's not as simple a conversation as, say, whatever Ferrari or Pagani or someone else would have, where you can actually just order a thing. And it's an involved transaction. They have their own car that they own, a donor car, they send it.
Right.
It has to be inspected, very thoroughly inspected and measured and make sure that it's never been wrecked and sort of all this other stuff. It's a high touch thing. And then there's a specification that's generally very elaborate. It's not, I'll have a red one with black interior or whatever. Right.
People love to specify all the minutia in there, right?
Sure. But as a thing to do, how do you know how many people want to engage this process? It's like I said, you can't just go look at other businesses necessarily doing the exact same thing. And that's the trick. You can look at things like Bugatti, maybe, a Chiron or something that is very elaborate. You travel there and so on. And I think they're doing 500 of those. The LaFerrari, I think there's 700, like 500 coupes and 200 convertibles or something. So by any stretch of the imagination, what we do is extremely scarce, right?
Yeah.
It's big business for us, relative to, guess where Singer was 10 years ago, but it's really, really small by the standards of a lot of other people out there. So the point is that our endeavors for a few more, Porsche tricks up our sleeve and some other things are still, at the end of the day, will be, very, very small in terms of the number of things out into the world and the number of people who with whom we'll interact.
Last year, we launched Petrolicious membership to empower and elevate our community who celebrate the Drive Tastefully ethos. From weekly member exclusive films, exploring the world's finest homologation specials or storied classic car workshops, to our quarterly print publication, Drive Tastefully, Petrolicious membership is your gateway into the most exclusive automotive content, period. Members receive priority access and preferred pricing to our classic car rallies and gatherings around the globe, and special member pricing on all goods and gear in the Petrolicious shop. Membership is 50% off during our special quarantine pricing starting at $29 per year. Visit us at petrolicious.com to learn more. Even though you guys are providing a circle coming to you with their own donor cars and so forth, I would imagine that there's still that kind of decision-making process amongst your clients who are either deciding, well, should I send my 964 to Singer or should I get a Pagani or something else? Do you guys know what your clients are cross-shopping against? Obviously, we're talking about, you know, billionaires who, you know, can pick these up easily, but there's probably also some people who are, you know, kind of really want one and are maybe stretching to get one, I would imagine. So they can't have both that and a Pagani, for example.
One of the biggest surprises of the business are the clients, right? Uh-huh. Again, sort of the whole business was a surprise, right? It wasn't constructed as a commercial endeavor, right? More of an artistic one, but
right.
We don't have a lot of Lamborghini buyers. Often you'll find collectors of 50s Ferraris, you know, that sort of, sort of Goodwood folks, right?
Uh-huh.
Classic Porsches, very significant Porsches. I mean, very significant Porsches. I would say that the cars that they're commissioning with us, or the cars they're sending us, and that sort of transaction is not nearly as expensive as a lot of what the other stuff that they have, right? Maybe some of them have been through that already. Like they've been through the cycles of, you know, buying a bunch of new stuff and going to us to do sort of a bespoke, you know, one-off restoration thing with them it would be fun. That's happened a few times, but I would say a lot of these folks have actually been through restorations and they have, you know, very important classic cars and so on. And when these restoration kind of endeavors they're very long, they take years, they're super expensive in a lot of cases, far more than what we do. We do have a few folks that just have, you know, two cars. There's a guy, yeah. You know, a couple of guys that stand out. They uh-huh. have a, you know, Honda minivan and they have a $725,000 911. Yeah.
Right.
There's some of those. Right. But then there's complete opposite, right.
You've got
200 cars and commercial airplanes as private planes kind of things.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But generally enthusiastic, really into the details, enjoying themselves. There we've had a few, you know, investor uh-huh. types, right?
Right.
That obviously occurs, but most of them are just...
They're driving the cars.
They're driving the cars. They're the guys going to Goodwood, you know, for a few days, and they'll have, you know, old racing cars and stuff, and they really just sort of get it. And they get how hard it is to execute things this elaborate, right? Mm-hmm. It just takes time. There's no kind of getting around it. You don't do that stuff easily. We've had a lot of kind of copycat type.
Yeah. There's been many.
Yeah. It's kind of like, all right, you know, there's another uh-huh. one. We keep seeing them and it's like, all right, good luck. Right. This is not, it's not like falling off a log. Like, this is very hard work.
Yeah. No, you guys have copycats, not just within the 911 world, but people trying to do the same thing with other models as well. other car brands. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, in theory, modernizing an older car isn't, you know, it's not something we invented, but it's really our brand. I say our brand as if it's something we constructed on purpose. I mean, we kind of did, in that we have a very strong OCD about things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're very particular about how some things are executed and how things operate. And we've built a brand, which is really just an expectation from the marketplace, right, of what Singer does, or what Singer, you know, what a Singer thing would be, no matter what we did. There's an expectation, you know, is that there would be a very high level of execution, aesthetic design, you know, beauty in these things that has taken a lot of work from Rob. And, you know, one of the factors that a lot of people don't quite understand is, in building a brand, one of the ingredients, what we've learned, is just time. Like, like executing like that, you know, car after car, year after year, time after time, over and over and over, you then have a brand. You start to build a thing where you are sort of known for doing something. It's just a reputation, right?
So, for sure, yeah.
Some of these others that we see out there, some of them are very cool, right? Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like, cool, we'll see you in 10 years and see how it's going. You have to be able to stick with it and fight. And, you know, it's not easy. And Rob did most of that, right? He was the hardest working dude I've ever met in terms of just sheer commitment. And I got to come in and say, hey, let's take this lightweight thing idea and turn it into a new era, right? Let's take one big step up in engineering, which will be intimidating, difficult, and expensive. And of course, that car went from $1 million car idea to a $2 million car idea. Needed all kinds of financing, and we were able to successfully sort of take a step up in terms of our capabilities and what that looks like to the outside world, to allow us to then take, you know, another step from there. You know, when we get further down the road. So
it's fantastic. I think there's a lot to save to, you mentioned Rob's OCD behavior, which I think has a lot to do with how prestigious the brand has become. He's very protective of what he does with the brand and says no in a very wise way to things that might otherwise cheapen the brand, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say maybe OCD is the wrong term. It's not actual,
it's a good term.
OCD.
Yeah, it's just, of course.
It's just a focus on... Well, there's sort of two elements. One is just an absolute determination that that you'll get to a certain result. Like, there's a thing that Rob wants to do, and he's going to make sure that he's going to get there. It doesn't matter what it takes. You'll get there. I guess that's not OCD, but you're going to get there. You're not going to give up halfway. You're not going to get almost there. It's not almost, there's no, you know, almost good enough. It's going to get to what you want to do. That's one part of what he's done. And it's a stubbornness, but not in an obnoxious way. It's just, it's what successful people, I think, maybe a lot of them have that trait. Like, you're, no matter what it takes, you're going to get to the finish line, right? Even
Absolutely.
If it's painful and sucks and you run out of money or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But then there's this other thing, which is his ability to, you know, write a hit song, right? There's not that many people who can do that. So his ability to design something that's beautiful is this sort of freak of nature thing that, I don't care how determined you are, you may not have that. Right?
Yeah.
You could be determined to build something that's ugly or whatever. And the two of us have a very high determination around what the final product would be. I'm more on the kind of mechanical side, how we get to that finish line, right?
It's gonna
be made of this. It's gonna sound like this. When when you're on the brakes, this is what happens. When you turn in, this is what happens. And really paying a tremendous amount of attention to that, because I have a similar determination that it has to result at, you know, in this way. Not necessarily into horsepower figures and all that stuff, but what happens when you're driving the car, and the thrill of driving a car at 40 miles an hour, right? That it can be thrilling, in a sense. And I'm very, very focused on that. And that's kind of why the things have come out and made out of the materials that they're made out of, and in the way that they're made out of. And then they look like something Rob drew. So you know, we're very, it's very self-indulgent for the two of us. We get, yeah. It's like we get to make something that the two of us want very, very badly. And then there's this element of luck, and the luck is that other people also want that.
Right.
That's the part that is the kind of fortune in a sense for us, is that the things that we want super, super badly, we've been able to fight and get and create. And it turns out other people like that. The two of us could like some nonsense crap no one wants, right? And then you don't have a business, but maybe we go and make it. And so it's really that simple. It's what it isn't, is some sort of commercial, like we're not designing these things with a spreadsheet.
Exactly. I think it's kind of like you see manufacturers put out a really sexy prototype, and by the time it makes it into production, it's been washed down and all those cool little details are gone and forth, because, you know, bean counters had a whack at it and, you know, all this other reasons. You guys can make their prototype and make the production car look even better. I mean, there is no prototype. You guys are just manufacturing a car, but you're taking the 964 and applying your magic to it without any compromise. And there is Rob's signature on there. There's a vision behind it. It's not a committee of people deciding that, oh, well, we need to consider this and that, et cetera.
Yeah. No, I would say if we had to design things because we thought we could sell them, I don't know that which is the business of very big businesses generally.
Yeah.
I don't think we'd last a week.
Right, because you're not trying to sell 10,000 or something like that. You're selling, you know, hundreds. Yeah.
Well, it's probably more simple than that. Is I don't know that we have this sort of brain power or bandwidth to focus on something that we're not completely in love with. Like I want that, right? So whatever we do next is because we want it personally. Maybe we can't afford it. It's so expensive. Yeah. But that I want that. Want it. I need it to be like this. And that has worked. That's what we're doing. And for us, that has definitely gone, I would say, many levels deep with DLS, because we got it. Mm-hmm. We dove into the mechanism, the thing underneath it, to go all the way through the whole thing, like every single component, and really assess it. And how far can we take it, even if no one will see it, and even if it's super expensive and this doesn't, you know.
But you know it's there and it's making a difference.
Yeah. That's right. And of course, it's funny because we've sold them and we still haven't told that story to our customers. We've told them a little bit, and you can kind of see it. You just start looking around, right? You see an engine out of the car, but they haven't seen it's like we made enough components to run a few test cars.
Yeah.
And all of those components just, you know, get the crap kicked out of them. And we haven't really shown them how beautiful everything is yet. We will, you know, commercially it worked, and they took our word for it, I guess.
Right.
But it was very difficult, I have to say. Very difficult. And traveling back and forth to England, you know, every month and all of that. So
were there times in the process where you thought that this is just crazy, it's not going to work, and you were close to giving up?
Not necessarily. There are some like kind of black box items in the car that you're going to endeavor to go do something. You don't really know how it's going to turn out. The rest of it was like, of course, you can take a trailing arm and work with and a front suspension and work with, you know, an F1 team, and you know you're going to get an improved component that's stronger, that's lighter, that will, as a result, be this sort of beautiful thing. Right? It's kind of like, you're not going to screw that up, right? In a sense. We set the targets, what the car has to do, what's going to come through the steering wheel, the seat, the pedals. I had absolute determination around. Like there wasn't maybe it should be like this, or it was absolute certainty. And Chris agreed with me, and Marino agreed with me, and everyone. So we really pushed to make that happen. But things like what's going to happen with the motor, that's where we took a two-valve, you know, old-school flat air-cooled six.
Yep.
And said, what can we do here? Right. Which is a motor that had, I think, 240 something horsepower, 3.6 liter engine. Mm-hmm. And what can we do? Like, how far does it go? And we started that endeavor, and you don't really know where you're going to end up. You know, theoretically in Formula One, they can forecast anything. It's amazing, right? But at the end of the day, there are still things like engine rooms. So you can forecast at this, you know, beyond aerospace level, but you still have to test it. Like as much as these computers can tell you and the amazing things that you can see to forecast what happens to, you know, metal under stress and air as it's moving and hot air as it's moving and all the other things that you can forecast, you still have to build it and you have to test it. And so at the end of the day, we didn't really know when the engine would run for the first time what was going to happen. It could have been a hand grenade. It could have just been a very tough struggle. Mm-hmm. And it ultimately became a four valve air cooled flat six that does 9,300 RPM reliably and runs. How would you describe it? It's like driving a 1,000cc motorcycle. It's the same kind of power delivery and this sort of, it just keeps revving. It keeps going. When it hits 9,300 RPM, it's still making power. It's not like it falls off and then shift. Yeah. It's being artificially slowed down. It's artificially cut. So we don't, you know, hand grenade the thing. It's a tremendous, we did not expect that. But if that just was a struggle, if it just wasn't making, it just couldn't hold itself together. If we were going through motor after motor, it might've brought the whole program down for sure. And that could very, very easily have happened. Like super easily. It could, you could have just, you know, we had several engine failures for sure, but we're quickly able to determine it was an actual certain component failure, a chain link actually breaking at the weakest link, funny enough, a few times. And we had some other things, but it wasn't this foundational problem. Like you can't make a four valve cylinder head work in a in a non-water cooled engine, which was the big question. It may just not work.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. Or it may work at a level that produces so little power that it's a huge bother. And you went around the block to make as much as a two valve motor would make and, you know, spent millions of dollars doing it. So no, it was a massive, that would have killed us for sure. That was the one thing that could have just said, all right, we just, you know, wasted a lot of time and a lot of money.
They pulled it off. Were you involved much or privy to the progress of the operations of the business prior to the whole DLS initiative?
No, in the first couple of years that I knew Rob and I was helping out, like I said, in this sort of consultant way, it was like a consultant friend. I mean, Singer was like four people or something, right?
Yeah.
And I was helping and, you know, and then I became very busy and I, you know, but I was always in touch and I was, like I said, I'd go to the party, I'd always get invited to the Christmas parties and, you know, stuff, Monterey and all of that. But, you know, I didn't like hang out at the shop, see how things worked. And when you start to get into business like that, where, you know, there's several cars, every car is, you know, 3,800 components, just call it whatever, 4,000 components. Those have to be purchased. They have to show up. They have to be installed. They have to leave, you know, and the sort of air traffic controlling of all that is, it starts to become complex for a small business. I never saw any of that. And then when DLS became a thing, which was 2016, in the first, you know, year and a half, it was just on a screen. It was, or more, it was just an engineering thing, it wasn't a car. It was nothing. It wasn't a car until, you know, for a year and a half until we started driving something that had, you know, components in the first engine and all that stuff in a mule car. And then started to look forward to production later, where you have to start putting in plans to order, you know, 12,000 components every month, right? And all the finance functions around that and all this sort of commercial things. I hadn't looked at what was going on at Singer until basically a year ago, I'd say a year and a half ago. And of course, what was going on was Singer had completely outsold its ability to operate all of this stuff, right? So many sales coming in, but the car wasn't really meant to, you know, the car wasn't engineered to, you know, remember, it's a service on an old car. It's a replacing of some components and a restoration of an old car. You can only scale it so much. It's not like you're ordering a bunch of new components and making a new car.
Right.
And it's just like dealing with suppliers. You bolt this thing together. Every car is different. Every car is specified different. These cars are 30 years old. You're restoring them, right? So it was sort of a program for the restoration of these cars that wasn't meant to be repeatable. And then a business that just wasn't. It was like, again, how would you know how many were going to be sold?
Exactly.
How big should the building be, and how many lifts? You have to start forecasting, right? You need to be prepared for that. And it wasn't prepared, but because I would say nobody would have taken a bet on how many restorations and how many clients the thing would have. No one would have taken that bet and said, you know, we should, Singer should raise money, investment, and build a facility to handle the, you know, few hundred things. It's going to laugh you out of the room, right? If you had suggested that to someone 5-8 years ago. So in a sense, if you were to look at a business, you would say they have the hardest things, you know, licked. Designing something that people want, which I would say, like I said, writing it, not that many people can write hit songs. Look in history, not that many people are capable of making things that, you know, you're just dying to have. Certainly when you look at, and not to give us, you know, tons of credit, but kids like what we do. Like, you know, I don't think a 16-year-old who sees a 86 standard 911 go by is going to take, you know, his phone out. But they see one of our cars go by and they go mental, right? And and you can imagine that there's subtle differences between the two. So that part is taken care of. Sales, can't stop them.
Sales are just coming in, right?
Well, we've never placed an advertisement ever. Not a single dollar.
You guys have so much earned media because everybody wants to talk about what you guys are doing. It's such a
sexy product. It's a third party sort of validation. So now getting the business to be a business and to sit there and think humbly to plan, right? Now you got to think years in advance and say, okay, well, looks like we have something here. We should probably be good custodians of this and start to think about what to do, and knowing our limits, knowing what we don't know how to do, and all of that. And at least knowing that, I think the recipe, that if it's something that Rob and I are completely obsessed with, that seems to be a good, like, okay, we've proven that works. Let's try that again. Right. I think so. You know, not thinking outside of our station in a sense, like, let's go make, you know, purses and handbags and go sell anything. Let's stick our name on anything. Right. Mm-hmm. And see if we can, we've been approached, like I said, for all kinds of collaborations and partnerships. Mm-hmm. And it's very flattering, but it's not for us. We're very, very conservative. I think the only thing we've ever done publicly with anyone is Michelin. Obviously Williams, but where we actually have this promotional relationship with Williams, and it's because they make tires that we have to have. I can't sleep at night if Sport Cup 2 is not on DLS. Like the alternatives at the time just weren't good enough, so we had to do anything it would take to get that tire on our car. And so that was a promotional relationship with Michelin, but that's kind of the whole of it. So now we're maturing the business, right? We're just, like I said, being more strategic about things like supply chain and so on, hiring folks who are very advanced in those areas. 150 employees, give or take, and growing.
That's crazy. Compared to just 7 years ago.
Yeah. You know, we have this horrible COVID-19 situation. Prior to, you know, earlier in this year, that 150 is probably going to turn to 180. And, you know, we had to just put on the brakes and just sort of go quiet and just watch. Watch what's going on. Like everyone else, completely puzzled by things.
Well, obviously COVID has put a pause on your operations, but what kind of impact has it had on demand for future deliveries?
We've continued to take new commissions at the same pace. That was quite a surprise. So I think last month we had as many as we ever did. I think a lot of people are you know, stuck at home like the rest of us on their laptop staring at cool things, right?
Yeah.
But what happens going forward? I mean, it's obviously looking like a very difficult global recession for a while. So we're in part of the maturing the business. We're going to design in that program. Like, we have to expect that new commissions will be lower and slower and all of that.
We'll have to see a 9-12 reimagined by Singer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not likely.
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
But we have years of current orders ahead of us, so we can kind of design the business around that. In a sense, we have new things coming out that we're super excited about, and it's really about being intelligent about how you bring those out and when and all that, being sensitive to what's a very, very hard time for a lot of folks.
For sure.
And our own staff and all of that. Fortunately, we also did a financing last year.
So you took on some investors?
We did. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. A fantastic group, which obviously that was meant to mature the business and develop some new stuff. But it also comes with the ability to survive things like this. Tough environments like this, if we need it, we don't need it, not yet, but we don't know how bad things will get.
Given the very unique nature of your business, I'm curious to get a little bit of privy into what your elevator pitch was and like what an exit strategy looks like for investors.
That's a good question. The pitch was similar to what I said. We have something here, right?
Yep. The brand speaks for itself. I mean, the brand is not easy to build, and that's, for sure, there's a ton of brand value there.
Yeah, and how often does a luxury goods brand come along? I would say in the car business, McLaren would be the most recent. And prior to McLaren, I don't know, tell me who's the newest, right? In terms of the luxury car space, maybe Pagani, right? But I can't think how old Pagani is. It's actually been around a long time.
25.
But also very, very small, right?
Right.
So we have something here. We have a lot of sales. We haven't tried to get any of those sales. So we know that if we get organized and take a look at what we're doing and look at what's possible, that we that there's something here, right? And we could start to think again 3, 5, 10 years out. And here's a program that we think would make some sense. And we were able to have discussions with some investors. I mean, these are investors of the highest level, right? They're very big thinkers, not even venture type investors. It's a $400 billion fund out of England. So very, very sophisticated, and expecting us to operate at a very high standard, not a few guys in a shed in LA wrenching on other people's 911s, right? That's not not the future of the business, right? And so the investment was based on current, like what the business is doing now, not versus what we propose we think we can do later, right? There's a little bit of that, but mostly around what we've already done. We already have all this revenue in the mix and all that stuff. So where we're going with it isn't something I can super discuss. I can disclose it in a ton of detail. But
well, congrats on that financing. Obviously, COVID has thrown a wrench in everybody's plans and operations and so forth. Aside from the obvious problems of COVID, what are things that keep you up at night, or are concerns to you in growing the business and achieving the goals that you guys have set for yourselves?
I think the two of us are always still humbled by the reaction that we get to this stuff. Nothing that we have done, nothing that you see on any cars was designed necessarily because we think we can sell this many units or this many services or whatever it is, right? It's just not how it went about. So people generally give us a lot of appreciation for things that are like ours, right? That was designed for me, the DLS, right? That's how I wanted it. I was like a kid in a candy store. I want to design a car to behave a particular way, and raw and look like something Rob drew. And for the appreciation that comes with that is super humbling. So you want to be very, very careful that the next things we endeavor to do aren't you know, pardon me, up our own ass, so to speak, like that we continue to think the way we think. And I have to be responsible commercially. This is embarrassing to admit, but one of the reasons that we want to do this and build a business so badly is because we want to keep doing this playing with cars thing.
Because you are people that would be your own market, your own clients. That's been a big reason for the success. You're not, in a way, you're not unique. There's at least a couple of hundred other people like you in the world.
Yeah, like I said, it's a huge motivation to run and grow this as a business. Is so that we can keep doing it. Just so we can keep doing it. It's like we get to play with cars every day, and we get to do it in a way that, you know, if we were, you know, hot rodding old Mustangs or whatever, like I said, you don't necessarily need to have finance work at that level. But what we do is very expensive. Engineering is very expensive. Prototyping is very expensive. The components that we're applying to these things, the leather, all that stuff, it's super expensive. People think that we're, you know, if they only knew the finances, you know, we hear it all the time. Like, we're making a killing, sell the super expensive things. There's no limit to the cost of componentry on these things. It is very, very surprising. And it's because of what we choose to put on there and the volumes. We're purchasing in extremely low volumes. It's everything is basically a one-off. It's almost the same price to have one of these pieces made or, you know, than 50. It's just not that. It's when you get to 5,000, you might see this sort of material change in the price. So what we do is very expensive. And of course, the cost of entry is expensive, meaning the engineering, the design work, the prototyping, the tooling, and all that stuff before you can even make a single component, much less an assembly of them or a group of them, is very, very, very costly. So, you know, that's the thing that we sort of operate at that this sort of level of finance because the things that we endeavor to do are complex and expensive. Like I said, if we were building racing cars, this would be a breeze. It would be a walk in the park, in a sense.
You don't need AC. You don't need comfort. Yeah.
Right. Well, you don't need leather. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you mentioned a few times that, you know, you were kind of on the sidelines because you didn't really see this as a business. It was more Rob pursuing his art. And then you jumped in when you saw the business potential. I'm curious to see if there's... if you could generalize that for others, as far as any kind of advice you might have to give someone who is an artist thinking about turning it into a business, at what point, like what signals should they look for that would tell them that, okay, there is possibility that there is a real business behind this and it's not just a one-off art type of thing?
I can tell you a little bit differently. For me personally, it was really the pursuit of the DLS car and the kind of, I'll do anything to get this done way of looking at the world. But that's how I operated prior. I just didn't really love what I was working on. The things I had done previously, you have to have an absolute determination and like a focus on getting to something. I don't know what, you know, I think it was just like, not that I would ever do it, but people who climb mountains, like they brave life and limb and they freeze and all that to get to something, right? To get to the, I know it sounds stupid, or a physician, a doctor who's goes through 7 years of medical school to try to get to something. And you really have to have that, right? If you're trying to get something accomplished, in Rob's case, he wanted to achieve this, a thing that had this effect, this item that has had this effect. He knew that other people would like it. He had that intuition. I don't know that I would have had that intuition. But when you see that, right? When you meet people who are super determined, that's when to pay attention, right? And you got to be super determined yourself. Like, that's a thing. If it's like, I think it's cool, but, you know. But when you meet people who are like, and there's obvious examples of that, right? You can look through history and just look at people in businesses, if you want to look at businesses or in racing or in whatever, where it's like, I don't care what I have to climb over or break through. I'm going to get to that, whatever that is. Right. And that's the thing. The thing I think that we've learned a few times over are when you meet people and they're sort of handed stuff, that's not necessarily a good teammate to fight. So what we have with Rob and I is we're both extremely determined to get things to happen. If there were any advice, I would say that when you meet people, whether that's an artist or a racing driver or someone who wants to do whatever it is they want to do, it's that kind of absolute focus. That's very compelling, by the way.
Yeah.
And we have that, but we have actually built, we have gone, I know this sounds kind of stupid, but the suppliers at DLS, the people who supply components, they're only those people, those companies. They're like so good at one thing. You will not find like the gentleman, there's a gentleman that runs a company called Kussmaul in Germany, and they make all of the metal work, bright trim, like on DLS. So yeah. Things like gauges, shifter, metal trim around windows and lights and all of that. He also supplies Bugatti for the Chiron. Every single thing is hand polished and made and finished, and it's absolute perfection. And his focus on doing that goes through every single thing that he does. And it's so obvious. It's so apparent. And that's the sort of compelling nature of every single one of the suppliers, some more than others.
Yeah. But
that's, for example, on DLS. And he has a successful, very cool business as a result. And I think that it's any kind of floundering or uncertainty, that's, I would steer clear, right?
Sure.
If they're not that sure.
Everybody's relentlessly pursuing, you know, the best that they can do.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what you've brought together and your suppliers. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of how we function, right? And then you read, you know, these fairy tales about other people who think that way. Some, you know, almost in cartoon in nature, like Elon Musk, like he will, it's like, he'll probably end up going to Mars. Everyone understand that, right? Like this is a hugely determined person who's going to make things happen. That would be on, you know, it's a very cinematic version of that. But even if you want to have a hot rod shop or a whatever, like you just have to be quite focused. Yeah.
For sure.
And those people can be very compelling. It doesn't even matter what they're talking about. I was quite focused real estate data. I didn't really like it at all, but I was focused on it, and you're able to sort of recruit people to help and invest and participate. I just didn't love it. I mean, it was not
a little bit less sexy than Singer. Yeah.
No, but this is very easy. It's just super easy to be excited and determined about, and recruiting people to participate is easier yet.
Cool. Well, Mass, thank you so much. Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up that I didn't cover?
No, it's nice to talk to you. I haven't seen you in a while. So
I know. We got to get together once we can socialize again.
Yeah, for sure.
Thanks again. And we'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining.
Thanks. Take care.
A special thank you to all of our Petrolicious fans joining us from all over the world. Join us next time for another conversation on Petrolicious Talks. I'm Afshin Benia, reminding you to always drive tastefully.